upends perception from reality at a fundamental level.
Countering gender digital hate and violence means addressing the polarizing distortions of digital life. How do we do that? I'm Andrea Gunrad from the Canadian Women's Foundation. Welcome to All Right, Now What? A podcast from the Canadian Women's Foundation. We put an intersectional feminist lens on stories that make you wonder, why is this still happening? We explore systemic roots and strategies for change that will move us closer to the goal of gender justice. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and our partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Métis, and Inuit territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations. Whether you're on social media, streaming platforms, dating, messaging, and meeting apps, or on game sites, if you're a woman, girl, two-spirit, trans, or non-binary person, you're at greater risk of hate, harassment, and violence. The fact that social media platforms seem to draw out and reward antisocial, polarizing behavior goes hand in hand with the gendered hate and abuse so common to digital interactions. We can't fix one without fixing the other. Nor can we ignore what social media does for us psychologically and socially. We use these platforms to build our personal identities. We use them to keep and find community and a sense of belonging and clout. This doesn't have to be a bad thing in and of itself. It's often a good thing. But it gets dangerous when platforms reward attacking and hurtful behavior, when they encourage the targeting of vulnerable people, and when they make it easy to exert power over those with less power. In that sense, it's easy to see why women, girls, and gender diverse people, especially those who face multiple barriers, are so unsafe in digital spaces. Digital spaces reinforce and amplify the imbalance, power, and abuse we know too well in our day-to-day lives. There is a glimmer of hope here. This is a human dynamic. Digital spaces are ultimately human built. The fact that they're like this is not inevitable, and it's not unchangeable. Over coming months, we're delving into this with leading experts and content creators, releasing in-depth episodes every week. We talk about the problem and what we can do to change it. We offer practical tips to help you in your digital life, and we talk about what it means to take back the tech for all of us. Chris Bale, professor of sociology and public policy at Duke University, joins us now. He directs the Polarization Lab. A Guggenheim and Carnegie Fellow, Chris studies political extremism on social media using tools from the emerging field of computational social science. He's author of Breaking the Social Media Prism, How to Make Our Platforms Less Polarizing.
I lead an interdisciplinary research team called the Polarization Lab, and our mission is to both do high-quality research on the key drivers of antisocial behavior on social media. So this is everything from spreading misinformation to polarizing behavior and harassment, but also to try to develop new technological solutions to address these problems. And, you know, I've been working on this for about 15 years now, 10 to 15 years. My interest in this space originated for a few different reasons. Living in the United States, it's a pretty polarized place, and sort of growing up with social media, I'm old enough to remember life without social media. So it's sort of inevitable that people in our generation ask questions about how technology is shaping politics and online behavior and harassment and all these things. And then also just sort of a lifelong interest and exposure to conflict in other parts of the world far outside the US. And I think that that also really stimulated my interest and appreciation for the urgency of solving these problems.
Social media polarization seems to be a huge and growing problem. What have you learned about how and why it happens?
Polarization is a complex, multifaceted problem in the U.S. And, you know, we need more research outside the U.S. And I won't be able to explain exactly how polarization emerges in all contexts. But in the U.S., it seems to be a combination of a few different factors. There's a historical story about how the political parties in the U.S. sort of drifted to extremes, particularly the Republican Party, long before social media was even around. Cable news stations, which people like to say they could afford to offend, because unlike the large networks, like, you know, your Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, you know, if they say something extreme, a place like CBC could get in trouble, right? But a small little niche organization like a Fox News in the US, especially early on, you know, they attracted audiences by saying crazy stuff. So, you know, that's 1990s. And then up through the 2000s, we start to see, you know, protean forms of social media, but we don't really see wide scale adoption of social media until probably the end of that decade. So long before social media came around, there were lots of other factors driving polarization, probably inequality, social isolation, all sorts of other stuff. And a lot of people want to ask the question, did social media cause polarization or you know, other forms of harassment? And I find it pretty much impossible to answer that question, right? We can't disentangle the role of social media from so many other factors. But I think what we can do is realize that social media has created some changes which likely didn't make anything better. I like to say that the thing that makes us human is that we care so much about what other people think about us. Compared to other creatures, right? That's what makes us unusual. And, you know, from birth, we have an instinct to sort of scan our social environments, try to figure out what other people think about us. And then we tend to cultivate identities that make us feel better about ourselves, right? And we jettison those that don't. Before social media, you know, we're all just kind of walking around in our communities, you know, we're getting feedback from each other, you know, or, you know, maybe you see someone smile or you get a head nod or something that sort of gives you some subtle cues about which identity is working for you. Fast forward to social media and things are just profoundly different, right? I can be anything to anyone. I can be on many platforms, fully anonymous. I can stretch the truth. I can bend the truth. And so at a fundamental level, the way that we can experiment on our identities has changed. You know, we're no longer constrained to what we look like in person, right? Like nobody who meets me in person is going to think like I'm a talented breakdancer, right? It's just like, I'm a pretty goofy person the second you meet me, you'd realize that, right? But online, like I could pretend to be, right? The other way things have changed, platforms interact with this human tendency in ways that I think are pretty unproductive. So, for example, we have follower counts, we have like buttons, we have all this infrastructure that gives us the sense that we have a heightened ability to figure out what other people think about us. And that's what we're addicted to with social media, is this tool that we can quickly use to figure out what other people think of us. But of course, if we rely upon those things, follower counts, like counts, all these things, we're getting a very distorted picture of what people actually think about us. And that's why I called my book Breaking the Social Media Prism, because I think the best way to describe what social media does and why it polarizes us is that it bends perception from reality at a fundamental level.
We've been talking a lot about the structural issues behind digital hate and harassment. I see that you get into the psychological level in your research. It gets personal, and we can see ourselves in it. It triggers another level of curiosity about what's going on.
One of the interesting things about the research my colleagues and I have been able to do is, in addition to studying people using what you might call digital exhaust, the little pieces of information they leave behind on social media sites that researchers like me can scrape using computer programs and, you know, try to make sense of. But then also we talk to a lot of these people. You know, we studied them, they participated in experiments with us, but we also talked to them. I think the best way to answer your question is to give the example of a guy who we met, who I'll call Ray, to protect his identity. Pretty interesting. We first started talking to him. He's just like a pretty likable guy. You know, he's going out of his way to say, you know, hey, I try to get along with everyone. You know, carefully says, you know, I don't care about race. People who talk about politics all the time sort of bother me. You know, but you know, overall, I just like to connect with people. So he has a relatively pleasant conversation with this guy, and then we go to look at his social media data, which we had obtained through a survey firm that recruited him to participate in our research. And this was the biggest troll I've ever seen in 10 years of studying incivility on social media. So it's like immediately a bunch of questions came up. You know, one, did we mess up the data merge somehow? Is this even the same person? Turns out, yes, we were able to, through some digital forensics, determine this is the same guy. His newsfeed is just post after post after post of meticulously photoshopped memes depicting liberal Democrats, especially women like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Nancy Pelosi, two prominent politicians here in the U.S., you know, in the most vile, you know, reprehensible ways. And so it's like every night this guy is changing from Dr. Jekyll into Mr. Hyde. And here's where I think the gap between perception and reality is so important. When we encounter someone online, we just see, you know, one side of their persona. And if you think about the incentive structure of social media, what do you get likes for? What do you get follows for? And why do you go there in the first place, right? We don't talk about enough about the motivations of social media users. And when we got to know more about this guy, Ray, we discovered, you know, he's a middle-aged guy. He's not married. He lives with his mom. You know, he's got sort of a pretty sad life. Doesn't have a lot of friends. He, like all of us, sort of has a quest for social status. You know, we want to belong. We want to fit in. And so he starts to explore using platforms like Twitter. And this is many years ago. You know, he starts to try out some content, and he's not getting, you know, many likes for his first few posts. And then he starts talking about Barack Obama, and then he, you know, says something a little more extreme and more extreme. Each time he gets more extreme, he gets more likes. You know, I can tell you, having looked at those posts, that the people liking his posts were some of the most extreme people on the internet. And the problem actually is that the most extreme people on the internet are also the most active users on the internet. And so that means that many of us are going to profoundly exaggerate how extreme everyone is just because these extreme people are hyperactive. But setting that aside for a minute, we can understand Ray's behavior, I think, as, you know, a kind of social feedback and reinforcement, right? Like, he gets what he needs, a sense of status and belonging, from this group of people that he's never going to meet in person, that he thinks, you know, is a vast and important group of people who are validating his views, right? You know, the motivation here is, again, what motivates all of us. Like, we want to be loved. We want to belong, right? Some people, like this guy Ray, need social media to get that validation. Most, or maybe even many of us, don't. We get our validation in offline settings, or through our jobs, or through our, you know, relationships. So we really can't abstract from the bigger picture here, you know, and especially in the area that you are focused on, right? Who are these people is a question I think so many of us are asking. And I don't think they're all like this guy, Ray, but I think many of them are. Understanding where they're coming from, I'm not saying we should sympathize with people who engage in hateful, abusive behavior. Quite the contrary. I think we absolutely need to do more about this. But I think effective interventions will require understanding their motivations.
You probably don't get surprised by much anymore, but I'll ask you what I've asked other researchers. Does anything surprise you about what you've learned?
I think I put on a good act, to be fair. You know, like, one of the things you mentioned, curiosity, and I really appreciate that comment about the book, because I do think that's something all of us could use more of. You know, if we approach these questions with outrage, right, we're not gonna solve them very effectively. In fact, we might make things worse if we attack trolls, right? Like, there's a fair amount of evidence as to why that happens. You know, but curiosity, yeah, like, pull back the curtain a little bit. Like, who is this person? You know, doing these interviews, you know, I often, you know, concluded these people were much more complex than I thought they were. So another good example, in the introduction to my book, I talk about a guy we call Dave. If you saw him on Twitter, you would think he is just a crude racist who is engaged in an argument about white supremacists marching on a college campus near where he lives. That's what I thought. You know, I looked at this post. I'm like, wow, this guy just does not seem like a particularly great, you know, great guy. You know, then again, we talked to him, which requires a little bit of, you know, curiosity. Maybe I don't know if we can say, you know, say it's brave, but like, actually trying to understand how the guy works. Turns out, you know, he's half Puerto Rican. He grew up experiencing racism as a child. He was motivated to engage in this argument about white supremacism because he worries that the liberal media is sort of turning racial problems into race problems in a way that is unwarranted and that masks the real type of harassment and humiliation that he experienced. So, you know, there's some complexity there. And I was humbled by some of the interactions I had with social media users. You know, I was sitting there being like, well, it's easy for me to spot misinformation on Twitter because I'm an educated person. But the thing that drives extremists crazy, I think, is when they perceive that everyone, especially academics like me or other kinds of activists, have a monopoly on the truth, you know, that we get to define what the problems are, right? It's a debatable point. I think we do a pretty good job on a whole. But that perception, again, we've been talking about the gap between perception and reality, the perception that we are subtly controlling the contours of the conversation in a way that doesn't allow people to participate is the thing that enrages, and I think even in some cases radicalizes people, makes them vulnerable to things like conspiracy theories and the kind of gang dynamics that we see in so many internet communities.
What I take from your work is that the relatable human search for respect and belonging has gone digital, and especially in social media spaces set up the way they are, that has its challenges.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, fundamentally, everybody wants to be respected. Now, you know, like, let's look at the current situation with, say, Twitter. You know, like, I think you and I would probably both agree it's a pretty hot mess. It's not as if the solution is just tear down the guardrails, let's have a genuine competition of ideas. That just misunderstands what social media is and why people use it. The number of people who go on a place like Twitter to have a productive, rational conversation about, say, the minimum wage is infinitesimally small part of the population. Most people are on there to entertain themselves, right? They're talking about sports or video games. They don't even care about or maybe even know in many cases about policies about the minimum wage. Other people are just out there to win status, you know, to gain, again, a sense of belonging and stuff like that. If people are out to gain a sense of belonging, this does not make them pro-social creatures who are going to try to naturally reach consensus, right? Where humans were sort of wired in team dynamics and group dynamics. And so, of course, you know, we sort of divide ourselves into, you know, rival communities and win status primarily by attacking the other side. Nobody is going on there to try to change someone's mind. Like, everybody knows it's futile to try to change someone's mind on social media, right? It's all performance. It's all theatrics. It's all playing for your side and trying to win the argument. It doesn't have to be that way, right? Like, I think one of the things that I'm particularly passionate about is, like, how do we reverse course, particularly for people from marginalized groups, right? Disempowered people, social media is almost certainly a net negative. When you start to look forward, can you change the incentive structure of social media? I think instead of making social media about winning status and engagement, no matter what the consequences, we can better define what type of engagement we want. You know, there's a lot of talk about algorithms and whether algorithms are radicalizing people. And, you know, there's a lot of complicated research on that topic. But I think one thing that a lot of researchers would agree about is that, you know, most of these social media platforms, they order information in our newsfeed or for your For You page by putting the stuff near the top that got the most engagement from other people, regardless of whether it's engaging, right? So to your point, you know, this post is getting a lot of engagement, both positive and negative, and is getting boosted. And then more people are getting pissed off and more people are getting pissed off, right? The structure of social media platforms is designed to promote viral advertising, right? You want to get as many eyeballs on something as possible. Just keep people looking at it. You know, we do need a way to keep social media engaging. So, like, if you want, you know, if you want to bore yourself to death, try setting your social media newsfeed to chronological order if the platform will allow it. I don't think anybody really wants that in this day and age where we're so used to information being curated for us. But the question is there something better than this engagement-based virality model to capture our eyeballs? And here's what I think. I think what we need to do is reward behavior that is consensus building, build that into these algorithms. So instead of rising to the top of the newsfeed for taking down someone who, you know, has a different political view, which is what's going on right now, boosts the people whose messages are getting positive feedback from lots of different types of people. Could be in the US, Republicans and Democrats, could be men and women, could be young people and old. And in this way, you're doing a few things. One, you are optimizing for consensus, right? You want to show people stuff that's useful, positive, and so on and so forth. But two, you're making the platform a much less fun place for trolls, people who are asking each other to play. If you are going to drift to the bottom of the newsfeed every time you uncivilly attack someone, then you're probably not going to use that platform.
You speak primarily about social media in the United States. I do wonder if you see anything particular about the situation in Canada and the rest of the world.
Well, you know the old saying, when the US gets a cough, the rest of the world gets pneumonia in terms of the economy, right? Like, I do worry. One of, you know, my country's chief exports lately has been polarizing social media. And the good news is this: there's variation here. It's a very interesting study recently came out in the journal Nature Human Behavior. And this is a group of European researchers. And they said, okay, you know what? We've been studying social media and politics, extremism, things like this for about 10, 15 years now. And there's hundreds of studies. Let's step back and try to do some accounting. And let's track things around the world. And so they looked at a number of different things. So they looked at studies that looked at things like, you know, does social media spread misinformation? Does social media create polarization? Does it reduce trust? All these kinds of things. And then they looked at whether the findings of the study suggested social media was primarily positive or primarily negative. And then they also measured where the study took place. And the striking finding from the study was that in the US and Western Europe and Canada, the net effect of social media was mostly negative. It's making things worse. Interestingly, though, for the rest of the world, it was basically the opposite. And this was shocking. You know, we all hear about Facebook being accused of facilitating genocide in places like Myanmar. And so we think that, oh, this has got to be, you know, this has got to be just even worse in other places. But so far, what the scholarly record is showing is exactly the opposite. And so I think it begs really important questions about how social media interacts with existing political structures. You know, Canada, like the US, has a relatively bipolar, Manichaean kind of political structure. In many ways, it's politically very similar to the US. So it could be that in these two-party systems, social media is sort of an accelerant, you know, gas on the fire. And in other places, like, for example, there isn't a strong civil society. There isn't a strong, you know, media presence apart from a state media. You know, it makes perfect sense that social media could enable new kinds of connection, enable people to gain access to new kinds of information, right? To partner with new people, to engage in microlending, right? There's so many positives. And so what I worry about in the big picture is that as we focus on the negatives of social media, and we absolutely should, like there's many, many bad things going on, but we also don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? You know, like a lot of people want to say we should stop using social media. It's just not going to happen. Social media is embedded in the fabric of pretty much every part of our lives. So the question for me is not, do we try to get rid of social media, but how do we make it better? And how do we optimize for positive pro-social consensus building behavior? If there's some skeptics in your audience, you might be thinking like, what is this? You know, do people really want positive stuff? Turns out, yes. You know, surveys of the US population, if you ask them, why does stuff go viral? They'll say, oh, it's because of, you know, people saying hateful, negative stuff. Then they'll say, what would you like to make things go viral? And they say, I would like useful stuff. I would like information. You know, I would like high quality information. I would like to hear stories about how people came together to fix things, you know. And yes, cute cats, which, by the way, is consensus, right? It's a complicated path forward. It's going to be different in different places. I think Canada will, yes, be very similar to the US in many ways, especially given our proximity, but also different. You know, the multiculturalism, the different traditions, you know, these are naturally going to create a different environment.
What can we as individual users do to make social media less polarizing and harmful to ourselves and others?
In addition to challenging the platforms to change, which we absolutely need, we need to criticize them. They need to be pushed in many, many, many ways, including by government. We also need to understand how our own behavior contributes to the bigger picture. far from saying, let's blame the victims here, right? But I do think when we intervene, we need to sort of adopt a first do no harm kind of perspective. For example, if we see some content we don't like, you know, we immediately jump into the comments and say, how can you possibly think this? This is wrong. You know, you're usually a lot less friendly than that too, right? But we get angry. We used to say in the 1980s, 1990s, when we were talking about misbehavior among large corporations, we would talk about voting with your wallet or your pocketbook. As individuals, we don't have much power except for what we buy. And now, for my money, it's not what we buy, but what we like, you know, how we engage. So do I doom scroll for another 2 hours and share my angry opinion with someone for another 2 hours tonight? Or do I just ignore it? I don't think ignoring it is a great solution either, right? Because that allows it to go unchallenged in some sense. But if we remember that our actions have consequences and will actually make more people look at this thing that we're trying to discredit, you know, we might think twice and we might pick our battles a little more carefully. So I think like being a little bit more reflective about how our behavior contributes to the bigger picture. And you know, we talk about supporting each other and, you know, we don't want to, that is a consequence of inaction too, right? People might feel unsupported, but maybe that's an opportunity to jump to DM, right? And just say, hey, just so you know, I find this thing that someone did to you reprehensible. I don't want to support it by replying in public, but just so you know, I got your back. Again, you know, we have to get creative. We don't get to control, you know, the algorithm. It's not an easy solution. I don't think there's any single solution, but understanding how, you know, we're voting with our like buttons, we're voting with our comments is a key part. We can also control to some extent what type of information we expose ourselves to. So for example, earlier I was talking about bridging-based algorithms that would reward consensus. We actually built a tool that a bot that would spread this type of content, and we put it out on Twitter until Elon Musk shut down all access to Twitter's data among researchers like me. But for a short time, you know, you could follow this bot and try it out. You know, while you're waiting for platforms to change, you can change them yourselves. And I predict, you know, we're going to see a broad decentralization of social media, more and more splintering into smaller and smaller platforms. In order to compete with each other, these platforms are going to have to give us more options, right? You know, more features. And one of the ones I predict we'll see is more and more control at the user level, right? For what your experience is like. People talk about algorithmic choice and something like Blue Sky and Twitter and, you know, Threads being part of the Fediverse, which is the decentralized platform that hosts platforms like Mastodon, right? So I think this is where we're headed. And, you know, maybe those choices will allow us to have more control over this too. On polarizationlab.com, we have a suite of free tools and apps, or what we like to call middleware. So these are sort of like apps and bots and other sorts of things that you can use in tandem with social media to try to improve your experience.
All right, now what? Check out the tools and research at the Polarization Lab by visiting polarizationlab.com. Get the facts on gender digital hate, harassment, and abuse by visiting our fact page on CanadianWomen.org. While you're there, read about our new Feminist Creator Prize to uplift feminist digital creators advocating for gender justice, safety, and freedom from harm. Did this episode help you? Did you learn anything new? We want to know. Please visit this episode's show notes to fill out our brief listener survey. You'll be entered to win a special prize pack. This series of podcast episodes has been made possible in part by the Government of Canada. Please listen, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. If you appreciate this content, please consider becoming a monthly donor to the Canadian Women's Foundation. People like you will make the goal of gender justice a reality. Visit CanadianWomen.org.
My name is Chantay.
Hey, this is the ROXANNE, and you are listening to CKUT.
When I see what happens to me online, it really is just how society treats women in general amplified.
Digital hate, harassment, and violence hurt so many women, girls, and two-spirit trans and non-binary people. Content creators who address gender justice, like Libby Ward, have a lot to teach us about it. I'm Andrea Gunradge from the Canadian Women's Foundation. Welcome to All Right, Now What? A podcast from the Canadian Women's Foundation. We put an intersectional feminist lens on stories that make you wonder, why is this still happening? We explore systemic roots and strategies for change that will move us closer to the goal of gender justice. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and our partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Métis, and Inuit territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations. Whether you're on social media, streaming platforms, dating, messaging, and meeting apps, or on game sites, if you're a woman, girl, or two-spirit trans or non-binary person, you're at greater risk of hate, harassment, and violence. Kelly Odenweller's research identifies common gendered stereotypes and assumptions about mothers and motherhood. They can easily make mothers feel as if they're not living up to an ideal. If other people treat them poorly because of these stereotypes, they can feel isolated, anxious, and depressed. It's a sense of caring community and allyship that can make a world of difference. No wonder motherhood content and content about raising kids is so popular in digital spaces. Mothers may seek it out to find belonging, connection, and representation. The trouble is that digital spaces also carry a risk for diverse mothers and caregivers. They might find themselves targeted online based on their motherhood as much as they're targeted for other elements of who they are. Over coming months, we're delving into gender digital hate and harassment with leading experts and content creators, releasing in-depth episodes every single week. We talk about the problem and what we can do to change it. We offer practical tips to help you in your digital life, and we talk about what it means to take back the tech for all of us. Our guest Libby Ward is a digital creator, speaker, and mental health advocate. She's known on Instagram and TikTok at Diary of an Honest Mom, and she's committed to changing the motherhood narrative. She's been recognized as a mental health advocate by TikTok and has been featured on BBC, Good Morning America, Global News, and more. Her best-selling journal, entitled The Honest Mom Journal, The Struggling Mom's Guide to Struggling Less, has helped thousands of mothers.
My name is Libby Ward, and I am a mom of two kids, 7 and 9. I am married, and I live in a small town about an hour away from Toronto. And I am a content creator and a maternal wellness advocate, which spans across TikTok, Instagram, my website, public speaking, a lot of different areas. And I came to be in this position in life by accident, completely. So I grew up in poverty, being raised by a single mom who had undiagnosed and untreated mental illness and moved most years of my life. So I went through a really turbulent childhood, and I made it my goal to really break that cycle as I grew up and became an adult and got married and had kids. So it's always been my mission to really live differently than how I was raised and try and impact other people for good with my story. And I've always been really passionate about supporting mothers. But when the pandemic hit, I heard of this app called TikTok. Started making videos about the hard parts of being a mom, the honest parts that I didn't feel like people were sharing. And I realized that I was not the only one that didn't enjoy every aspect of motherhood. And I wasn't the only one that struggled with people pleasing and perfectionism and overstimulation and my mental health and so many other hard parts about motherhood. And it not only helped me to heal and feel more whole and more empowered to prioritize myself, but it really set me on this path of advocating for mothers in general and letting mothers and women know that we deserve to be whole human beings who are well and taken care of, so that, number one, because we deserve it, and number two, so that we can pour that out onto our kids and affect the next generation and the next generation. And so that's why I call myself a cycle breaker. And so I often make content that is funny or silly or heartfelt, but my goal is always to encourage and empower mothers and women to live as their true whole selves. And it is such a privilege to do so. And I love that I get to interact with and learn from and connect with and validate and curate and be a part of this community online that is so diverse, where I can hear so many stories of different women and different mothers, and go and spread that message farther to hopefully change the narrative of what it means to be a good mom and what it means to be a mom.
So there's sexism, and then there's the particular brand of sexism that mothers face. It must be challenging not only sharing your life as a creator, but also sharing your struggles with motherhood.
Every single day, I get comments and DMs from people who don't understand my perspective on the world, either because they have a different lived experience, or because they see a 10-second snapshot, or one part of a story or experience that's actually quite nuanced. They don't know my history, they don't know my past, they don't know my traumas and my mental health and all of those things. And because of that, and because of the things that they are carrying, they project onto me these opinions and hate and harassment, or just rude, nuanced things that can be hurtful, but that I've learned to reframe in a lot of ways. And it can come anywhere from me sharing a reel, showing how much I appreciate my husband, my partner, for being an active participant in our household and raising our children, and people saying things like, well, that must be nice, with that undertone of, that's not what should be expected, and you are so lucky. And it's almost this bitterness of, that's not how men are in the world, and almost you don't deserve that. And that's also me reading into it. But I get a lot of these comments from either women saying, that must be nice, because of course there's so many women living in partnerships where they don't have a supportive partner. They don't have a partner who carries part of the load. And so when I get comments like that, I have to remember that that is their perspective, and it could be coming from jealousy or resentment. And they're not necessarily trying to attack me, even though I might feel attacked. That's really just their perspective and realizing that they're at a different place of learning. They're in a different place in their life. I also get a lot of comments from men about the things that I talk about in motherhood. And as a woman, you know, comments like, well, you shouldn't have had kids in the first place if you didn't want to do everything. Or comments about being a lazy stay-at-home mom, which is always so fascinating because I'm not a stay-at-home mom. I am a mom who works full-time from home. But I get a lot of different comments from men and women in different and some similar positions in life who just make a lot of assumptions. So it's perpetuated by the messages that we get in society. So if the women that you're surrounded by really buy into this narrative that if you choose to have children, it is completely the woman's responsibility to give up her identity, her career, her passions, her need for sleep, her need for alone time, her need for quiet. And if you choose to have children, that's on you to figure it out. It's not on the partnership. It's not on society. It's not on our workplaces. It's not on the cultural norms and how we interact with our grandparents and extended family. It is this individualistic idea and this gendered idea that if two people choose to have a child, the woman, the mother, is the one that should have to give up all of those things. Mm. And both men and women perpetuate this idea for a variety of different reasons, whether it's because the people they're surrounded by are saying those things and parroting those things and their eyes haven't been opened to a different perspective, or whether it's because it benefits them.
Yes.
I mean, why would a man in a heterosexual relationship who gets to go golfing every Saturday from 9 until 3 and gets to spend every Sunday afternoon watching football and gets to go to work? I say gets to go to work because when you're a mom of little kids and you are exhausted by the needs of everybody else, it does feel like you would just love to go to work and be alone in the car for 20 minutes on the way to work. You know, they get to have this alone time and a chance to be autonomous and a chance to have fun and a chance to connect with other like-minded people and have adult conversation and have both a family and a fulfilled experience. Why would they want to change the social norm that women should do it all? It's not a benefit to them. It is actually a benefit to them, but they don't see it mm-hmm. as a benefit to them that they would have to give up those things in order for their partner to live a more fulfilled human experience. And it's a really sad reality that mothers feel as though they have to give up their identity when they become mothers. And it's really sad, and it takes a lot of internal work to realize that we're worth more than that. And I personally see it every single day online, where women and men are just continuously buying into this narrative that we should, this quote, die to self simply because we have had children. And it's really breaking a lot of women and affecting their mental wellness. And I believe robbing men of the experience and the wholeness that they can get, and the fulfillment from filling a caregiving role and from being more than just a paycheck, and that connection that we all so desperately need. You know, we all know that we're dealing with this crisis right now of connection, where people are feeling so isolated and so lonely. And it's a benefit to all of us that we have a more equal society, where men and women and mothers and fathers can all live as whole human beings, regardless of whether they have children or not. I think sharing my life online and the hateful comments that I get is reflective of the broader experience of women in general being held to a completely different standard in our society that men are held to, that we should be able to carry the mental load and to be the default parent, or if even if we're not parents, that we should be able to be the caregivers for the people in our lives and perform perfectly at work while having a baby and then coming back to work immediately and working like we don't have kids and having kids like we don't work. And when I see what happens to me online, it really is just how society treats women in general amplified. I am seeing in my DMs, in my comments every day, the little microaggressions that women who never share their lives online face every day when they go to a work party, or they show up to work 10 minutes late because their kid had a meltdown, or when they go to a family get together on Sunday and all the dads sit around having a beer while the women are taking care of the kids and cooking. And then Grandma Sandra comes along and says, "Well, I did it just fine when I was raising seven kids. Don't you complain." But I no longer take it personally, because I really just see it as a reflection of what is happening everywhere in society.
One of the good things about social media is that it can allow people to voice the unvoiced and share the undershared. I imagine your followers must express gratitude for that in what you do.
I would say that 98% of the comments and DMs I get are positive.
Yeah.
It has changed my life in a multitude of ways, and it has given me the drive to do more and share more. When I initially started receiving hate for sharing about these hard topics, it knocked me back, and I thought, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I can take this on. But the more women that reached out and said, "You're the first person who has shared this experience that I've had, and I have felt completely alone in the world. You've changed my life, or you've changed my perspective, or you've given me the confidence to see a therapist, or you've given me the confidence to have a hard conversation with my partner. You empowered me to go back to work. You empowered me to stay home and not care what anyone thinks." That is what drives me to keep going and realize that by sharing about the hard things, that's what's changing the narrative for women. That's what's empowering us to say, you know what? I am not crazy for being overwhelmed. Any human being would be overwhelmed with what I'm carrying. I am not needy for having emotions and sharing those. That is a normal human experience, and those emotions should be validated. And maybe it's not that there's something wrong with me. Maybe it's there's something wrong with society or with my partnership or how people treat women in general, and to look outside of their own experience and say, it's not just me. Because as women, we tend to self-blame, self-shame. And the more shame we have, the more we sit in isolation, the more we don't want to share, because goodness forbid, we're the only one who's had that experience. What does that say about me? And it really puts us into this dark corner. What I want to do is allow all women, all mothers, to see their individual needs and in their individual circumstances, how they can be empowered. There's no one way to be a good mom. There's no one way to be a good woman, to be a good person. There's no such thing as perfection. And we're sold this idea in society that if you tick all these boxes and do all these things, then you'll be good enough. And I just want to empower each individual woman to step back and say, what do I want? And how can I get that? While having to navigate a society that might tell them they're doing it wrong or that they're bad.
As a creator, what tips or words of wisdom would you share for anyone trying to get safer online?
Just because they say you're wrong, it doesn't mean that you are wrong. So much in my life, I have looked to other people to validate that who I am, what I believe, what I say, what I share is right, that it's enough, that it's perfect, that it makes me good enough. I had to do some really deep work to not only ask myself who I was and what was important to me, but I had to use that to build my confidence in order to share. So that when people say things to me, I'm not taking it all at face value. I'm saying, is this coming from someone that I trust and that I would go to for advice anyway? Or is this coming from some weird guy in a basement who has no idea what he's talking about, and I wouldn't even ask his opinion on what jacket I wore today? I'm not going to take that feedback in the same way. And I also am not going to take feedback that misaligns with my values or is coming from someone with a different set of values. So I had to really figure out who I was in order to put up a shield to the things that could be really painful to me. I never want to give the impression that I have arrived, but something I continuously have to do is realize it's not my job to save the world. If I constantly put all of my energy into advocacy and changing the world and changing the narrative and sharing my life and putting myself out there, there's going to be nothing left for me to give, to have, to enjoy, to enjoy life, right? I think as women, we often feel tasked with not only carrying our households, fixing everyone's problems, fixing boo-boos, taking care of our mental health, taking care of all the different things. And then on top of that, we task ourselves with changing the world. I only have so much capacity to impact other people. And that's not a reflection of not me being enough. That's a reflection of me being a human being. So I may have a massive impact on a certain demographic of mothers who may be empowered to take their lives into their own hands. I am not going to have the same impact on corporate working mothers or on teen girls. I'm not going to have the same impact on aging women or empty nesters. I'm not going to have the same impact on a boardroom of men who need to change their opinions. My demographic and my calling in life, I believe, is to empower and advocate for mothers. And that's okay. It also means that I don't have time to volunteer at my kids' school as much. And it means that I don't have time to chit-chat with my neighbor as much because I am running a full business that takes a lot of my time that actually a lot of people don't understand how much time goes into it. And I've learned it's not my job to prove to other people how busy I am and why I can't do everything. It's my job to remind myself that I can't do everything and to stick to my lane. And when I think about myself as a new mother and maybe the microaggressions I experienced when I wasn't online and when I wasn't receiving the level of hate I was receiving, my corner of the world was pouring into my children and teaching them the values that I had and reading them diverse books and exposing them to diverse people and sharing diverse perspectives and TV shows and different things with them. I wasn't talking to a million people on the internet. And me talking to a million people on the internet is not more valuable than a woman at home reading her child a story about diverse people and shaping their minds to change the next generation. And so the advice that I would give to anyone that's navigating the weight of making all of this change is like just one step at a time. You're literally a human being. No one person is going to change the whole world. We all have these different seasons. And maybe you have a different lane than me, or maybe you have a different season than me, or the person next to you, or that you see someone else on social media making big impact. Maybe they're not making the same impact as you're making with the little old lady next door to you who you make her day every day when you talk to her. It's really hard as women to feel like you're carrying everything and you see all the problems and you also want to fix all the problems.
Let me ask you this. Any words for those who may go online and get tempted to lash out at others? How can they take a step back?
First of all, we need to remember that we all have so much more in common that we have in differences. The unfortunate part about social media is that we often just see one slice of someone's experience or story. And it is so easy to cast judgment when you only see that one slice. Number one, remember that every single person who is sharing something online is a human with human emotions and human experiences and human faults. That person maybe is not perfect, and they maybe don't have the words to articulate what they actually mean. And so when you pick apart the way they're saying it, it's not actually helping anyone. And I'm not saying that you should never disagree with somebody online. There's definitely a time and a place to say, that's not cool. That's discriminatory. You are harming people by sharing that in that way. But we will never make progress if all we do is attack people with different perspectives and other them and silo ourselves into here is one way of thinking and here is another way of thinking and we are completely opposite people. Ask yourself, why do I want to make this comment? Is the comment to educate or empower or share a perspective that might help them not post harmful things? Or are you sharing because it triggers something within you and you are projecting some of your own pain? Unless you are contributing to the conversation in a positive way, all that's going to do is be negative for the person who's receiving it and for you. Who actually feels better when they leave a mean comment on somebody's post? It doesn't make you feel better. You just get riled up and you go back and forth. And then who changes their mind? Literally nobody. Mm-hmm. But if you can find the commonality and the common ground, and if you actually want to change something, you need to see them as human first and you need to connect with them. All of the change that I've made in my life and how I see the world has come after I have connected, truly meaningfully connected with someone with a different lived experience. I have not changed my perspective simply from facts or simply from hateful comments or simply from something someone told me. It is me having an interaction with someone on a very human level and hearing their experience.
What do you think needs to change to end gender digital hate and abuse?
That's a big question because a lot of things need to change, of course, and it's really easy to come up with solutions and not have an actionable plan for how to implement them. And maybe this is an ambiguous answer, but I truly believe that connecting with people on a deep level, whether it's in social media, outside of social media, who live diverse experiences, is what is going to lead to social change. Part of the issue with the algorithm is that as soon as they figure out what you like, they just keep showing you the same thing over and over and over again. So let me make that concrete. There are posts that keep coming up on my feed, and I save them because in my mind, I have the intention of stitching that. So that means taking a piece of it and then sharing my commentary on it or sharing another perspective on it. And these videos that I'm saving sometimes are opposing to my beliefs, right? So it could be a mom sharing about how moms who go to work are abandoning their children for the state to raise, and they're essentially not good mothers, and they're our highest calling in life should just be to mothers. And if they are not your number one priority 24/7, that you are not a good mother. And so I saved these posts because I want to stitch them. But what happens is it tells the algorithm, Libby likes these posts. On an individual level, we need to be following and interacting with different types of people who live different ways. And I'm talking about myself as well. If I only saw content that aligned completely with my values, I would be blind to a lot of the struggles that these other people, other mothers might be facing, how to even reach them, because I wouldn't understand their perspective and the people they're surrounded by. So I think we all need to be better at not just following things that completely align with us so that we can understand others. And on a broader level, the algorithms need to change so that if you decide to follow someone, you see their content and they don't just push certain types of content to certain people because somebody paid them a lot of money to do it.
What I take from you is that we can do things to curate our digital experiences in a better way than just accepting what we get out of the box and platforms.
It takes time and it takes intention and it takes effort. It's not something that just happens overnight. It is intentionally opening your eyes, looking for people who live different experiences and truly engaging in what they're saying and trying to put yourself in the shoes that they are in and the stories that they are sharing, listening to their stories and just imagining for a second what it might actually be like to be in their shoes and experience the world how they experience it. Recognizing our privilege. I mean, I say that as like a white woman who's middle class, and I have access to so many resources and forms of media and different types of people, and I have a large network. If you have more power, to use that power, you know, to use that to make connections with people you wouldn't normally make them with, and to give a voice to people who don't normally have a voice. If we're talking about how to do that on social media, it's finding people that are different than you. It's truly interacting with them, showing them that you see them, and maybe sharing them with people in your circle as well, because we all have limited circles. And if we can just expose one another to different people and build those connections, it really makes a big difference.
I like what you're saying. We can put on our empathy hat in social media with an active approach. Even in the risk and unsafety, we can take steps that make our time online quality time on a human-to-human level.
Let's break it down really simply and practically. If you see somebody's content that you appreciate or that you want to learn more about or you think is interesting, that you want to learn more about, interact with it. The algorithm knows to show you more of the things you interact with. So it's not enough just to follow someone who's different than you. When you see their post, you need to like it. You need to comment on it. You need to send them a DM and say, thank you so much for sharing. I can imagine it might be really hard to get some comments you get, but I really appreciate you sharing your perspective with me. Even if you don't completely agree with them, even if you don't completely understand, to even say, thank you for taking the time to share your perspective with me. It's helping me to grow. It's helping me to learn. Reach out to people with diverse experiences and say, hey, who would you recommend I follow if I'm trying to learn more about XYZ? It doesn't just stop at checking the box. It really goes into engaging with people in a meaningful way and an intentional way, and then sharing the love to maybe others in our life who maybe aren't as tuned in to wanting to change the world or changing their perspective or making social change. Some of the biggest change I've made in my personal life is simply by sharing the stories of people I know with other people I know. You know, when I think of a friend that I know who has lived a pretty sheltered life, and, you know, her parents are married and her partner's parents are married and they haven't struggled socioeconomically and they live in a small town and their circles are relatively small. And if I hear one of them make a comment about a new group of people moving to our small town who are of a different culture, is it going to be more impactful that I shame them for having that perspective and cut that friendship off? Or is it going to be more impactful to say, I met this person at the grocery store the other day, and sharing the humanness and sharing the stories of people who are different is what makes those micro changes in people's perspective about other people.
All right, now what? Check out Libby Ward on Instagram and TikTok at Diary of an Honest Mom, and visit her website, diaryofanhonestmom.com. Get the facts on gender digital hate, harassment, and abuse by visiting our fact page on CanadianWomen.org. While you're there, read about our new Feminist Creator Prize to uplift feminist digital creators advocating for gender justice, safety, and freedom from harm. Did this episode help you? Did you learn anything new? We want to know. Please visit this episode's show notes to fill out our brief listener survey. You'll be entered to win a special prize pack. This series of podcast episodes has been made possible in part by the Government of Canada. Please listen, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. If you appreciate this content, please consider becoming a monthly donor to the Canadian Women's Foundation. People like you will make the goal of gender justice a reality. Visit CanadianWomen.org.
My name is Debbie, storyteller, dub poet, partly raised in Montreal, 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 launching my new CD 333. You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
Afternoon, you're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing your wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked at the CKT 90.3 FM.